In a world that seems just a touch wacky right now, at least it does to me, it seems appropriate that we seek support and guidance from someone you can depend on. Abbott and Costello. Bud Abbott and Lou Costello were one of the most popular of comedy duos in the U.S. during the 1940s and the 1950s. And they are probably best remembered for a particular routine. And the content of the routine is quite amusing, I find, but it was their seeming frustration with one another that made it arguably one of the most popular comedy routines of the last century, certainly in the English language. And without, I think, any dispute, it is a masterclass in timing and delivery for anyone who would want to be a comedian. We are going to watch just a portion of one of their many renditions of this bit. And for any of you who want to see the whole thing, I will post it online with this sketch with the sermon recording later on today. The thing is, you do need to listen carefully. Lou Costello speaks at the speed of light. So speaking of light, Gene, do you want to just grab the lights there? And so now, for one more time, who's on first?
Abbott and Costello.
I understand it. All the boys that's over there, they're going to have a big baseball team, and I understand you're going to be the manager.
That's right.
Yeah?
Yeah,
well, if you're
going to
be the manager of this baseball team, I would like to join myself.
That's all right.
I would like to know some of the guys' names on the team, so when I meet them on the street or in the ballpark, I'll be able to say hello to them.
Well, naturally, I'll introduce you to the boys and a regular bunch of boys we've got. But you know, strange as it may seem, they give these ball players very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Strange names, like Dizzy Dean and...
Daffy
Dean.
I'm their cousin.
Who are you?
Goofy.
Well, let's see. We have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out.
And then who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Yeah, you know the fellow's names?
Yes.
Well, who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name?
Yes.
I mean the guy playing first?
Who?
The fellow playing first?
Who?
The first baseman?
Who?
The guy playing first?
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who?
The fellow playing first.
Look, who is on first?
Have you got a first baseman?
Yes.
Who's playing there?
Yes.
All I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
No, wait a minute. No, wait a minute. Don't mix them up. What is on second?
Who's on second?
No, who is on first?
I don't know.
He's on third now. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
You just mentioned his name.
If I mention the third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
Never mind first. I don't know. What's the guy's name on third base?
What's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
Have you got a third baseman?
Certainly.
Then who's playing third?
Who is playing first?
What's playing first?
Then what's on second?
I don't know.
Third base.
You got an outfield?
Well, surely.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I don't know. I just thought I'd ask.
I just thought I'd tell you.
So tell me who's playing left field.
Now, who's playing first?
What's playing first?
What's on second?
I don't know.
Third base, yes.
Have you got a catcher?
Well, naturally.
The catcher's name.
Today.
And tomorrow's pitcher.
Now you've got it.
That's all. We got a couple of days on the team.
Well, I can't help that.
You know, I used to be a catcher, too. I'll get behind the plate, do some fancy catching.
Yes.
Tomorrow's pitching on my team, and the heavy hitter gets up.
Yeah.
Joseph Valentine, the heavy hitter. Now, Valentine gets up, and he bunched the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he bunched the ball, me being a good catcher, I'm going to throw Valentine out of first base. So I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now, that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
That's all you have to do.
Let's just go home now. Abbott and Costello's genius here is the ability to apparently misinterpret one another, and they do it in an epic way. They're talking past each other, right? What we describe as talking at cross purposes, crosstalk. Both the characters are sincerely trying to communicate and desperately, and even, I would say, impressively failing. They're both speaking the truth. They're both interpreting reality as best they know how, and it just ain't working. Have you ever found yourself in that situation? You're in a conversation with someone and you suddenly realize that you really have no idea as to what they're talking about. And yes, you've been chatting with them rather amiably for like 10 minutes. This happens to me with a little more frequency than I normally care to admit. And maybe it's a hazard of the profession, but sometimes there's the assumption that I know more of the backstory than I really do. I'm actually quite clueless about it. And then to compound the problem, I discover the other person is speaking in euphemisms. You know, they're trying to use a toned-down word to avoid saying something that might be a bit embarrassing or harsh or unpleasant in some way. And because I don't seek clarification, because as you all know, I suffer from the very British problem, which is I don't want to appear rude. And if you want to hear more on that particular burden I carry, refer to my June 23rd, 2019 sermon on that subject. I end up completely misunderstanding what's going on, or I leave the conversation quite mystified. Or have you ever found yourself talking to someone about X and then discover later on that they were talking about Y, and you've managed to completely misconstrue what the other's saying? And sometimes that's simply a choice of words. We find ourselves separated by a common language. For example, we talk about peace, and we know what we mean. And the other person is using the same word, say peace. And we suddenly realize that they mean something quite different. Because religion and culture can define that term in different ways. Peace might not merely be the absence of violence, say. It can mean something more, something different. And assuming that we know when we don't really know, well, it can get a bit weird, you know. In fact, it can get a bit dangerous. Even within our microculture here in Qualicum Beach, I'm going to assume that we're all fairly familiar with that microculture. Even in our own religion, when we talk about love, I mean, what do we really mean? It requires some clarity, some definition, some common understanding of terms. Because love can mean different things depending on circumstances and intention. I mean, stopping someone to tell them that you love them can be wonderful. And it can be perilous if you don't have the same understanding of what we mean by that term. On the other hand, there are those moments when the penny drops, and I suddenly understand what I first didn't understand, when I get a fresh insight into what the other person means, and I realize that there's a whole lot more going on than I first knew. That sometimes can be a bit unnerving, but other times it can be inspiring, it can be delightful, it can actually be quite liberating. I would dare say it can be gospel. It can be very good news. Last Sunday I made reference to how the gospel writer John remembers Jesus often leaving his audience scratching their heads. In the gospel of John, Jesus sometimes says things that, at least initially, baffled those he was in conversation with. You remember from last week how he was meeting with Nicodemus one night and he was talking about being born from above. And Nicodemus couldn't immediately get his thinking away from the literal image of being physically born or reborn. And that left him, understandably, quite confused. Of course, Jesus was actually trying to open him up to the notion of a kind of a spiritual birth, of being born in a spirit-led way, and seeing and participating in this whole new world, a whole new kingdom, in fact. Well, this kind of crosstalk occurs all the way through the Gospel of John. There's lots of examples of this. And there's just, I think we can say, a whole bunch of who's on first going on. But it's through the initial misunderstanding that readers and hearers of these stories are given an opportunity to grow in our own understanding. It's a bit like listening to or reading a parable. In that destabilizing initial reaction of, hold on, that can't be right, we get taken more deeply into the subject. In today's reading, Jesus and his disciples are on a journey north from Judea back to their normal stomping grounds in the region of Galilee. And instead of making the usual detour around Samaria, which would add a day to their trip, they decide to cut through Samaritan territory. In fact, John says that they had to travel through Samaria. Perhaps they had some time constraints or mission plans that we're not privy to. It's not really clear. But the reason that many would bypass Samaria and add extra time to the trip is that, well, Jews and Samaritans, let's just say they didn't get on terribly well. Once upon a time, religious kinfolk. Now the Samaritans and the Jews had some important theological differences. And you know how it can occasionally be in family disputes? They can, over time, sometimes turn into a special kind of ugly, as mere difference of opinion can shift into being perceived as betrayal. Remember, one of the reasons that the parable of the Good Samaritan works is because Jesus knew that there were precious few people in his audience who could get their heads around the idea of a Samaritan also being understood as in any way good. This is, of course, a difficult concept for many of us amiable and thoroughly lovable Canadians to understand, what with our curious belief that none of us could ever really have enemies. Anyway, that Jesus and his fellow travelers were in Samaria should clue us into the possibility that there was some danger here, that they were out of their comfort zone and maybe looking over their shoulders just a little. It's about noontime. They stop for a spell, and we learn that Jesus is a bit tired from the trip. We also learn that he's alone. Having access to water, the disciples have now gone looking for food. They're resting at a place called Jacob's Well, and you can still visit it on the West Bank today, I'm told. And a local woman, a Samaritan, appears and she is there to draw some water. And we're told that Jesus spoke to her and asked her for a drink. So, okay, this is our timeout moment, because this is a way bigger deal than it first looks. Remember how I was rattling on about boundaries a couple of Sundays ago? Well, know that Jesus is crossing one right now. Actually, he's crossing three. Because three issues are at play here. The first being that, of course, she's a Samaritan. And Jews did not speak to Samaritans. And they would certainly not share a cup with any one of them, because table fellowship was not extended to such people. This was a bit like a Tutsi and a Hutu sitting down for a chat in the 1990s Rwanda. This is a conversation that is happening in spite of centuries of raw hostility. Second, this is a male-female interaction, and a devout Jewish man of the time wouldn't be alone with a woman who wasn't family, and vice versa. And a woman or a man certainly wouldn't engage in any conversation with a person of the opposite sex that they didn't know. And third, as we learn later, she's got some issues. And honestly, speculating about the causes of said issues is fraught with peril. But as the biblical commentator Barbara Brown Taylor noted, there's likely a reason that she's there at noon and not with the other women in the community there first thing in the morning when it was cooler. She likely had some sort of reputation with someone who was talked about and not welcomed. But in despite these things, Jesus begins a conversation with her, and my impression is that some kind of banter ensues. He asks for water, and she said, well, Jews don't normally ask us Samaritans for a drink, to which Jesus replies, and if you knew the generosity of God and who I am, you'd be asking me for a drink. And you know what? I'd give you fresh, living water. And they go back and forth on this for a while, and she eventually clues in that this is no ordinary Jewish traveler. He's something special. Seems to be offering her hope. Then Jesus steers the conversation to her issues. And she tries to deflect that, and he won't let it go. And eventually she speaks of the hoped-for Messiah, and Jesus, for the first time, reveals that he is the long-promised Messiah. Note that this is not to the disciples that this is revealed. No, it's to this fallen Samaritan woman. The triple outsider, as Brown Taylor refers to her. Huh. You notice that God always seems to choose the most unlikely person in the biblical story. It's the younger brother. It's the smallest person in the smallest tribe. It's a teenage girl from the sticks to bear the Messiah. And of course, Mary Magdalene, the first bearer of the good news, we celebrate every Sunday that Christ is risen. God seems to love subverting what we would expect to be the right person. And the first person to bear the news that Jesus was the Messiah, a nameless Samaritan woman at the well. Maybe not nameless. 10 days ago, it was the World Day of Prayer. Some of you attended that gathering, and that got me to thinking about being asked to preach at that same gathering about 6 years ago, and I was given this gospel reading. And in my research for that sermon, I discovered there's all sorts of rich church traditions about the woman at the well, just like there are for many New Testament characters. But within the Eastern Orthodox tradition, the woman at the well is venerated as a saint. She's remembered as Saint Photine or Saint Photini, which literally means the luminous one, the enlightened one. Her saint's day just passed on the church calendar. It was February 26th. And tradition has it that she was baptized on Pentecost, and she became one of the first evangelists. Though in fact, she was that well before her baptism. Remember, our gospel reading this morning tells us how she left her water jar and went back to the city, and she urged people to come and to meet Jesus, which is what evangelism is really about, as best I can tell, anyway. From our reading, she said this, John said this. She said to the people, "Come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done." You know that this woman's actually been remembered as an apostle in many parts of the church. She was a big-time church leader. And she was referred to by that very term as an apostle for the better part of our church's first millennia. After which time, we slipped into pretending that women weren't leaders in the church. And by the way, if you want to see some really good leadership right now, watch Dr. Bonnie Henry, BC's chief medical officer. She's the real deal. I just listen to her and I go, oh, I'm okay. Anyway, that's for another sermon. In the tradition, Saint Photini was a missionary to Samaria, to Rome, to Turkey, and eventually to Carthage in North Africa. The traditional account also reveals that she had 5 sisters and 2 sons, all of whom became converts to the Christian faith, and all of whom had notable lives of faith. It's even said that she oversaw the conversion of the Emperor Nero's daughter, which I suspect might be connected to the belief that she was martyred in the year 66. Hers is a wonderful, bracing, and inspirational story, the story of the woman at the well, remembered as Saint Photine. Saint Photini. But if you notice, we have this propensity for getting stuck on who she was prior to her meeting Christ. That's telling, and it's also kind of sad for me, because I think that the point of the story is in meeting Jesus and how that completely changed her life. Completely changed it. And really, it really is that in meeting him that our lives get changed and get really interesting, I think. It's in meeting him and following him and meeting him and following him and meeting him and following him and meeting him and following him. You get the drift. It's a process of meeting and following. It's in that process that the story, the capital S story, continues to be told, and through which the kingdom of God is so often seen. I've said this here before, so you may remember it, but it's the assertion that your theology isn't likely to be sustainable if it doesn't preach at the gates of Auschwitz. I think that's a thought worth hanging on to right now. If your understanding of God and the human condition doesn't make sense in the face of great evil or facing something terrifying, then it probably doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. And I know that there's great evil in this world, and there are, as we all know, some terrifying things. We live in a time, in truth, we've always lived in a time, when what we say we believe is being tested. So this morning I'd like to declare that the good news is that through Jesus' death and resurrection, through his life, through his teaching, salvation has been given to us. And that you and I, we've been made right with God. I love that no matter how wretched we are, no matter how good we think we are, well, God just loves us anyway. Is determined to have us no matter what. Is relentless. And God will not abandon us ever. God will stick with us not just to the end, but God will stick with us beyond. Just as it was with the woman at the Samaritan well, Saint Fatini. None of what we've done or not done in the past is going to bar us from the amazing grace and the amazing love of God. In fact, it's right there for us. It's offered like a cup of cool well water in the heat of the noontime sun. It's nothing you can earn or be good enough to deserve. It's just given. It's just wonderfully given. So clasp your hands around that cool cup and drink deep. Forgiveness, reconciliation, peace with God, peace with one another, peace in a world that seems just a little mad. There's new life. Just as the woman at the well who ran to tell all who'd listen about this person, this Jesus she'd met. And you have met him, haven't you? Just as she knew healing and a changed life, we can experience that too. And it's a well that never runs dry. And it can be drawn from over and over and over again. To you, my friends, who have tasted the living water that Jesus offers, I wonder, what are you going to do? How are you going to respond to this amazing gift that has been given to a parched world? Amen.